My inspiration for this talk was a book that I read 2 summers ago, God and Goddess in the World, Conversations in Embodied Theology, by theologians Carol Christ and Judith Plaskow. This talk happens to come at a time in my life when I've been wrestling once again with the concept of God. This probably started many years ago, but was certainly accelerated since the 9/11 tragedy, the horrific gang rape of a young woman in India, and reinforced by many other examples of human stupidity and cruelty. This cruelty, seemingly unmitigated by the storied power and mercy of the God that most of us were taught to worship. This has left me unsettled, sometimes even irritated at the childlike belief of some people in the limitless goodness of God. It is not my intention to take on all of that today. I do, however, note that it's part of the context. I note its juxtaposition with the deep connection, satisfaction, awe, and beauty that I experience, quite unbidden and unintentional, when participating in some of our pagan group's gatherings, which are largely inspired by and populated by women, when reading feminist theology, and when in the presence of nature. Something is going on there, and today's talk is both an intention to share some thoughts and questions that I hope are useful to you, but also perhaps to do a little bit of the wrestling out loud. In North America and Europe, feminist critique of Christianity looks at scripture, doctrine, but also organizations and at the field of theology itself through different lenses and with different assumptions. There's far more to it than substituting feminine pronouns for the male-centric words that we use for God. One concern is that theology has for centuries been what Mary Daly calls hyper-rational, with endless debate about words. What does it mean that Christ's nature is divine and human? What is grace? What is sin? In addition, the debate has been almost exclusively by men. Women, who in case no one noticed, make up half the human race, were not allowed into these lofty conversations until really very recently. For example, radical feminist and theologian Mary Daly only graduated in 1953. Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, a European-born theologian, received her PhD in 1963. And in fact, the first female students at Yale's theological school were Christ and Plaskow, who wrote the book, and that was in the 60s. Carol was once introduced by, I think it was a department member, as our department bunny. Yeah, and some of her fellow male students would fall down before her in the hallway and worship her. Right, okay. And when she protested about some of the sexist treatment, she was told, look, you're probably going to get married and have babies. You're not going to finish your PhD, so let's not make a big fuss about this. Interesting. One of the early criticisms of Christianity by women was that the sacred texts essentially told the stories of men. From the viewpoint of men, women were minor characters for the most part. And even exceptional women have their stories told through the voices of men. Nowhere do we get to read about the internal experience, surely absolutely incredible, of being visited by an angel and giving birth to someone whom you were told was going to be the savior of the world. I imagine she had something to say about that, besides, you know, the hymns and the canticles that were written many centuries afterwards. Surely the women of Israel had something to say about Job's suffering. And the daughters of Lot might have had something to say about being offered up for a potential gang rape. The record is almost silent because women are character actors in the drama, almost part of the backdrop. In what field of study would it make sense to ignore the experience of half the population? Of course, part of the problem is that theology has traditionally not primarily concerned itself with human experience. Much of its preoccupation has been with concepts and with the transcendent, as if there was an eternal, platonic, perfect form or concept up there, and that philosophers were striving mightily through rational discourse and careful study to grasp truth with a capital T. By contrast, feminine theology demands that the lived experience of human beings, and not just the high words of male academics, form the basis of faith traditions. The God of the Old Testament had no parallel or connection to the lives of women, for the most part. He's cast as a father, creator, king, conqueror, and disciplinarian. The loving element was far less obvious, and it really tends to emerge more in the New Testament. The religion was based on these unquestioned assumptions. Now, although it began in the earliest 2 centuries as a more egalitarian community and included women as deacons and really the equivalent of bishops, the doctrine of the church was largely developed and codified in the third and fourth centuries by an increasingly powerful organization. The church modeled itself after the Roman Empire, arranged as a hierarchy in which power, position, rules, and their enforcement were paramount. It is interesting to note that stating these heretofore unquestioned assumptions made Plaskow and Crist very unpopular in theology school. Their views were dismissed as unprofessional and unworthy of discussion. Yet in rational discourse, the questioning of untested assumptions is an essential process in scholarship. This dismissive response stands at odds with a later conversation Crist had with one of her mentors, a gentleman of some repute, who told her that he thought she had one of the finest theological minds he had encountered in some time. But we see that the sexism on which both our society and the Christian religion is based was deeply entrenched at that time. Here's an example of how these assumptions have affected theological studies. Fiorenza notes that the Apostle Paul was often described in the Greek translations with the title diakonos. Now, when referring to a male leader, scholars translate that word as minister or deacon. Whereas in the case of Phoebe, one of the most prominent women in the early church, the same word is translated as servant. The second title given to Phoebe was prostatus, usually translated as helper or patroness, although in the literature of the time, it had the connotation of leading officer, superintendent, or governor. So again, these unquestioned assumptions were affecting even something as potentially direct and obvious as a translation. Another implication of classic male-based theology is visible in the attitude towards the human body. In Christianity, the body and mind suffer from the artificial division already present in Greek philosophy. That which is rational, which exists in some perfect form among the gods, is the ideal. The human body, our human appetites, are things to be conquered, even considered inferior and unclean by some. Now, I would agree that the worst that humans often do comes from our biologically based instincts for safety and survival of me and mine. That instinct, if unchecked by our equally instinctive capacity for love, connection, compassion, mercy, and self-sacrifice, can be dangerous. So they were onto something, but, you know, too much of a good thing, led to many iterations of Christianity that have become mired in rules, in ironclad definitions, an agenda to control the dirty, squalling, grasping, sexually demanding body. The traditional story of Adam and Eve places much of the blame on the shoulders of the weak-willed woman who was fooled by the devil in the guise of a serpent. Traditionally, women have been very much identified with the body, while men were seen as supremely rational, so that by definition, women were weaker, controlled by their emotions and their earthly appetites. Now, if you read the news, you want to see people controlled by earthly appetites and power hunger? Check out the posturing of male political leaders on the international stage on any given day. So I don't think it's gender-based, but I digress. One of the most hurtful results of male-dominated theology is the unconscious, deep, and pervasive psychological wound in women that has left them feeling less than men for centuries. Women have had to fight hard to overcome the sense of being unworthy of equal power or having their talents and needs taken as seriously as those of men who run the main institutions and sources of power. And I hasten to add, it's not simply a question of men doing that kind of oppressing, a lot of women have taken on that role as well as they seek to align themselves with the patriarchal power. Too many women settle, give in easily, give up dreams and talents in order to look after others. I was reading an article today from a British newspaper about a lot of homeless people in the UK putting up with unwanted sexual relationships just to make sure that they don't become homeless again, and that a lot of that, for example, affects women. A man who leaves mate and child to pursue a career is rewarded with promotions or lauded as devoted. A woman who makes her family secondary to work or art is scorned as abandoning, selfish, and cold. Still, in the 21st century, we have gender disparity in wages, women composers who barely have a presence in the film world, the glass ceiling for women executives and politicians, the infamous "give us a twirl" comment about Eugenie Bouchard's tennis outfit after she won a championship. The Me Too movement shows us that women still occupy an inferior position in the psyche of Western society. And as for the developing world, in many cases things are only worse, with underlying religious beliefs, if not the root cause, being used historically as justifications for this refusal to share respect and power. So feminist theology, how is it different from the traditional Christian theology? Well, one important fact, right at the outset, is that feminist theology is not uniform. Some theologists have strongly challenged the Abrahamic religions from which they come. Plaskow believes that she can do the most good by reforming her Jewish tradition, so she has stayed within that. Others have left the Christian world, and many have been drawn to earth-centered theology. Like their male counterparts, not all feminist theologians see God the same way. Plaskow sees no evidence of a conscious divinity as an individual, but understands God as the ground of all being, including all good and evil. She writes, "If we identify God only with the good in the universe, that leaves chaos and evil as some independent force beyond God's control and co-equal in power." For her, there is good and evil inherent in the creative process, perhaps a little bit like the creator-destroyer duality in Hinduism. She does not yearn for nor believe in a perfect, loving, and reliable deity, but says, "For me, community trumps consistency, partly because I believe that all community, like all reality, including God, necessarily contains problematic and conflicting elements." So her emphasis is on the community of humans, how we think about each other, how we treat each other. Carol Christ understands goddess, and that's her general word, not eliminating the masculine aspect, but putting a bit more emphasis on the feminine, although she sees them together. She sees this deity as the intelligent, embodied love that is in all being, a personal presence that cares about the world. She experiences God in a deeply personal, intuitive, and embodied level. She also acknowledges that the universe is some mixture of good and, you can call it evil, you can call it harm, you can call it chaos. She writes, "If all we know of that exists is a mixture of the good and the bad, life and death, ugly and beautiful, if our creativity and creative power that births and sustains the world brings forth both good and evil, then how can the goddess be less than ambiguous? How can the goddess be the ground of all being if she does not," and here she quotes Isaiah, "form light and create darkness, make weal and create woe." The two authors are united in some aspects. I quote, "We are critical of those who identify the divine feminine or the goddess primarily with feeling, relationships, intuition, and the unconscious, while asserting that the divine masculine represents rationality, independence, and even warlike aggression. This leaves the dualisms intact and does not criticize the violence inherent in patriarchy. But we are equally critical of those who fail to see that the vast majority of feminists who are experimenting with female imagery for divinity within traditions do not hold such simple views. Feminists are in fact striving to reunite the separate poles of thinking and feeling. Theologians of all genders and styles wrestle with the concept and experience of God. Many see a universe that unfolds with God rarely intervening, and even in cases of horrific suffering. Yet this is at odds with the conventional Christian view, which has enshrined the expectation of help in its liturgies and its prayers. Christians are often calling on God to provide mercy, strength, wisdom, cures, safety, success. In private, they also pray for sun on their wedding days and for the winning lottery numbers because they promise they'll use it for good. Christianity, at least in its traditional form, still relates to God as a father who may grant a boon, including justice or mercy. Crist and Plaskow explore this in several chapters of their book. Feminist theology generally, and goddess spirituality in particular, do not assume that prayers will be answered. Plaskow interestingly writes an entire chapter on the experience of Job. As she reads God's comments to Job, the message that she finds is that justice is not inherent in the world. It is our job to create it so that the universe may unfold. For Carol Crist, divinity is conscious and in relationship to all beings and all of creation. The goddess is right in the relationship between atoms and the forces that sustain the universe and keep it moving. If we see consciousness and intelligence throughout creation, then it makes sense that the source of those things would also have awareness and intelligence. As creation changes and unfolds, so does the divine, in her view. Although she recognizes that there is creative and destructive potential and action within the divine, ultimately she experiences it as nurturing, loving, relating, and caring actively about us. Goddess is good, however, not necessarily omnipotent. For in both, if both, in Christ's view, she would have intervened to avoid or mitigate intense and destructive actions in the world, and particularly needless suffering, whether human-created or that of the natural world. And so this is a huge theological issue. A lot of theologians have looked at it from many, many schools, and you know, we're barely scratching the surface of that with these comments. Feminist theologians reject the fundamentalist insistence on certain texts, traditions, and truths. Because humans created these texts and their interpretations, everything is on the table for review, discussion, and challenge. There are no sacred cows for them. They also insist that images of the divine must reflect the diversity of creation, at minimum, diversity of gender and color. Anything less than that to them is inaccurate and unacceptable. In fact, their book was written as a series of dialogues with each other. They address each other by name in their respective chapters. As friends and colleagues, they have no need to bludgeon each other in a contest of words and wills, but are seeking to uncover or perhaps even create a reality, maybe multiple realities, by collaborating. This is a fundamentally non-patriarchal process. A fairly immediate implication of this new view is that women have begun to see themselves reflected in the divine and to acknowledge the holy within themselves. We are not an afterthought, not a derivative, neither of a rib or otherwise. We are not a cause of human suffering due to original sin. Even for those who do not believe in these literal teachings of biblical lore, the fact is that Christianity has dominated the political, psychological, artistic, and literary landscape of our European-based society. And so these untested concepts, unchallenged concepts, have very much flowed through that fabric and affected how we think. The idea of women's inferiority is so embedded in our worldview that it's like water to fish. It's not something they even notice, it just is. For us to make progress as a just society, this needs to change. at a more equitable view of the prime cause would, I think, make a significant impact on our collective psyche. And if women's voices entered the discussion more fully, what other diversity, language, and representation are in the wake? Our white middle-class Eurocentric view is not the be-all and the end-all. And so for those of us who perhaps explored other religions, those of us who have become familiar with the Aboriginal worldview, we get a bit of a taste that there's a different way to look at things. Plaskow goes on to write, "Those who want to use God, she language want to affirm womanhood and the feminine aspect of the deity. They do this by emphasizing that which most clearly distinguishes the female experience from the male. A male or female deity can create through speech or through action, but the metaphor for creation that is uniquely feminine is birth. Once God is called female, then the metaphor of birth and the identification of the deity with nature and its processes become inevitable. This has implications for whether we choose to relate to each other and to nature on the basis of power or of love. If we value power, growth, success, dominance, and glory less, I think we would work individually and collectively towards greater acceptance of each other as we are and strive for more just and loving relationships. We might more fully value our bodies as sacred rather than as commodities or things to shape for someone else's approval. It also speaks to the central message of many environmental movements, that we have a responsibility of stewardship for the earth. It is not simply a resource in our search for greater power and material well-being. I've noticed that even the words of some liturgies still largely use images of God as triumphant warrior, smiter of enemies, and king. The prayers and invocations are all about praise and glory. Which, you know, that's fine, but those are power-based concepts. And asking God to use his power to make people safe, cure ailments, make the world better, all great things to ask for, but again, it's very focused on power. And only the more progressive churches are emphasizing the message of relationship. This is not unique to feminist thinking, but relationship and cooperation are central concepts in which feminist thought, and certainly most of feminist theology, is based. Is the feminist world-friendly view of religion a disruptive force? Oh, yes, it is, and that's part of what I value about it. It elbows into the old clubs and classrooms, demanding a voice to question assumptions and the patterns of theology as they have been. This new view might engender less bowing to sacred cows. It might mean that theologians who adopt a new way of approaching their material might be less inclined to grasp desperately onto the idea that they have the truth, or use the concept of heresy against each other. Are there disagreements and power struggles within? Probably. Put two human beings in a room, you're going to have conflict at some point. But what we can hope for is that the principles that guide us, both in religious life and in our societal relationships, will benefit from this upstart approach, which has put everything on the table for discussion. Disruptive? Surely. But then so was the movement for democracy, and that has come to be something that we not only value and demand, but we reverence it in our fifth Unitarian Universalist principle. Disruption and questioning are necessary processes in the evolution of our thought and our relationships, even with the divine. There's so much more that I could have written about this. We could be here till the end of the month. It was a job to winnow it out. Maybe there's another service in there somewhere. I don't know. I've barely scratched the surface of what I loved about this book, but I just wanted to bring out a few key concepts that I thought we could relate to and that might influence our thinking. My hope is that it's given you some food for thought and that it has inspired me and that inspiration might flow through to you as well.